join us later. And I hope, I guess we're forming a quorum with those two members. Just want to welcome members for today's meeting. It's actually our extension to the process that we started before the recess, the Good Friday recess. We had hoped that by last week we would have concluded or completed the process in order for us to be able to start writing our speeches for the budget vote. But this was necessary that we extend it up to today. Can we give a special welcome also once more to ITEC under the leadership of Ubabu Nzimande. You all welcome. Yeah, we are partners. We're not enemies. We are all servants of the people. So don't see us as people who really want to do something else other than, you know, help in pursuing our journey towards making our people's lives better. So we are all serving the nation, even though we serve the nation in, from different, you know, angles or different portfolios, but we in the same portfolio actually. You must feel free and don't be nervous when you are with us, because I always hear people feeling jittery about being before a portfolio committee. So our intention is for us to engage with the intention of serving our people's better, nothing else. We are not doing this for ourselves. We are doing this for to help ourselves to grow better in serving our people. So I want to welcome you again. Last time we did send you back to do a little bit of a rework into the document that you had submitted to us. And want to appreciate the fact that you did that, and now you are here to present once more your document, which it has more clarity now. And the fact that you did that shows respect to us and cooperation also, and we really appreciate that. Thank you so much. May we, without further waste of time, allow Secretary to give us apologies, if there are any apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the only one that I was going to table is literally just walked in now, so there are no other official apologies for the record at this moment.
Thank you very much. We had anticipated that by 11 o'clock we'd be done with the first part of this meeting of today. Yeah, we're hoping that by that time we'd have actually wrapped up the work, our interaction with ITEC. May we then continue by handing over to Mr. Nzimande to lead us with the presentation.
Good morning, Chairperson, and thank you once more for this opportunity. I would like also to greet the other members of the Portfolio Committee and also thank them for a second audience that I'm having with you. And my following our last presentation, as the chairperson explained, we were sent back to go and rework or to provide explanations in respect of some of the aspects of the annual performance plan. And my team on this side of the table did that and really tried our best to provide an explanation that on the face of it, when you read it, you know, talks to you as plainly as possible. You'll have noticed that the documents that are before you are a truncated version of what you had previously. This is because we thought it would be appropriate just to zone in on the issues in respect of which we were sent back, as opposed to going through that big wad of information that we did the last time. So, in a nutshell, you have this presentation, which is what is on the projector there, and you have this document, which is an extract, basically, from our APP, with the only thing is that the wording there have been amended to take account of the comments and the feedback that we received at the last session. With that, I will skip the first six pages of the presentation and go to page 7. Which is where we speak to the annual performance plan. So what I have done, or what the team at ITEC has done, is that in the presentation, from page 9 onwards, we basically, we'll get there though, we have basically provided a table which on the one side uses the language that appeared in the APP before, and then next to that language the explanation that we have now given in this document. The idea, as I said, being just to make, you know, the language accessible and as plain as possible. I thought it would be appropriate to start first by talking to the descriptive elements of the table that appears, the first table that appears on page 3 of this document. Sorry, page 2, not page 3, page 2, so it's the second page. One of the points of difficulty in our last presentation was how we had presented the baseline target and how we had presented the annual target. So I thought, let me start first by explaining what baseline target we used. And you'll notice in that table that we now have a descriptive wording in brackets which says, the baseline target is the actual audited performance results for the last for the preceding period. And this is consistent with what the National Treasury's Framework for Strategic Plans and Annual Performance Plans requires. The only thing which I must point out to you members is that at the time of preparing the plan, the latest audited financial figures were for the period 2016 to 2017. So what will appear then under that headline will be the ITEC's performance in that particular year, as reflected in the audited figures of ITEC. And then when you go to the adjacent column, which talks to the annual target, that is the target now for the period start, which started this month in April, ending in March 2019. There I explain again that our performance is driven by the actual number of investigations that we conduct because we have received applications in that year. So, unfortunately, we do not know at the beginning of the year how many investigations we're going to receive, but because it is the applicants, it is the industry that uses our services, which comes to us and says, we've got a problem with sugar, or we've got a problem with poultry imports, help us. So what we then do is to say that the target for the year will be determined by the number of applications that we actually conduct in the year. So if you go down that column, you will see that, in fact, maybe before I go there, one of the important aspects about our work is that the speed with which we carry out the investigation is paramount, because you are responding to a situation that is already impacting industry more often than not. So that then has become a key performance indicator. So in conducting our investigation, we've got certain key decisions that we make, which then affect the speed with which the investigation is completed. So the first decision we make is to initiate, whether or not to initiate the investigation. So when you get an application from the poultry sector, for instance, the first decision is, is there a case? Yes, initiate. So that has to be done within the shortest space of time. And then the second decision, and this is in the context of anti-dumping duties, the second decision you make is the magnitude of harm that is caused by the imports so severe that interim relief is required, i.e. whilst the investigation is going on, do we then provide some interim relief? If the answer is yes, you then impose provisional measures. We impose those pursuant to what is called a preliminary decision or a preliminary determination. So once you make a preliminary decision, which is in the first phase of the investigation, that okay, the interim relief is required, you then make that decision to impose provisional measures. And then you go to the last phase of the investigation, which then grants longer term relief. In the context of anti-dumping measures, longer term relief is final duties which will remain in place for a period of 5 years. So what you're trying to do then with these key indicators is that you must move through those decisions as quickly as possible. So what we do then is to set targets for each phase. So for the initiation, it's 2 months, if I'm not mistaken. For the first phase, phase one, preliminary determination of provisional measures, it's 6 months. And then for the final phase, it's 10 months. So what the targets then measure is whether you have met that target in respect of the investigations that you have received. So if this year you have received 10 investigations or 10 applications, in 8 of those, if your target is 80%, you must have met the turnaround time, or the time you must have finished each stage of the investigation within the prescribed time. If you received 100 applications, in 80 of those, you must have initiated within 2 months, you must have reached your preliminary decision within the first 6 months, you must have concluded the final investigation within 10 months. So that's what then it is. So members, if I then take you to again on page 2 on the annual target, you will see that the wording that we've now revised, that we've set out, which is I think more self-explanatory, is the following targets should be reached. This I'm just reading underneath the column annual targets. Phase one of the anti-dumping investigation should be finalized within 6 months of the investigation in 80% of the cases investigated. So you're saying that in this current financial year, if we're going to receive 10 investigations, 8 must be finished on time. If you receive 100, 80 must be received on time, must be finished on time in respect of phase one. And then phase two of the anti-dumping investigation should be completed within 10 months in 80% of the, sorry, within 10 months of initiation in 80% of the cases investigated. So again, it's that same principle. With trade remedies, the only types of investigation which have got two phases are the anti-dumping investigation, safeguard investigation, and countervailing investigation. Sunset reviews, which are also a species of trade remedies, have got a single phase, so those must be completed within 10 months. Accordingly, when you compare the preceding period with the current period, you say, in the preceding period, I finished 80% of my investigations within the prescribed time. In the next period, I should aim to finish to match that performance or better that performance. So that is how basically our performance targets are structured. And if you've had the opportunity to look at our presentation, what we have done there is basically to give you on the second column, under 2018-2019 annual performance plan current, we give you the wording that we had in the performance plan when we first met. And then in the second column, which says explanation of the 2018-2019 annual performance plan, we give you the wording that you now see in the document before you. This was to enable you to see the changes or the explanation that you have made in respect of each of the descriptors that you had previously said you do not follow. And having dealt with the first page of this, you will notice that the same formula then is applied in respect of the balance of the document. And I don't propose to take you through each submission. I would like to just perhaps halt it there and request you to then perhaps to ask questions if perhaps I'm not clear on that. I think that was the key issue that we identified, which in respect of which we are required to come back. Obviously, there were questions that we asked. We'll deal with the questions that the person has agreed that I can deal with the questions now. But I thought, let me just focus on this aspect of it, which is where the meeting stopped the last time.
Thank you, Babu Mande, for that explanation. And as you recall, this was an example that was set. And from what you said is that everything else follows suit.
Yes.
The explanation is there, and I think, like you had put there, under anti-dumping investigation, the note there is understandable.
Yes.
And we understand that without the baseline info, it's sometimes difficult really to make an assumption or a projection. So it therefore means that you are using the new information, I mean the new target, instead of basing it on a previous baseline. This is what it's saying.
Yes.
So the target 6 is a new, I mean the 6 months, it's a new target. The 80% within the 6 months is a new target.
It's a new target,
yes.
And what we are saying there is that if last year we did 70% in 6 months, this year we will do 80% in 6 months.
But last year you didn't have any baseline. Last year, in as far as your
yes,
the audited financial year.
Yes.
I carry your baseline is on the 2016-17.
Yes, that's right.
Because next 2017-18
still comes.
Is not yet audited.
Correct. Yes.
So you are saying based on the figures of 2016-17.
Yes.
You are not able to use any information that was audited. So I want members to have a clear understanding, so that whatever baseline that you put, the new baseline, it won't also reflect what transpired in the previous financial year.
It doesn't reflect what
that is 2017-2018.
Yes, that's right.
It's only 2016-2018.
Correct.
Okay. I'm not sure what members say. Are you satisfied with the corrections and the explanation? That is clear.
Thank you very much. No, I think the explanation then makes sense of what the presentation is all about. I think next time around, what should happen is that this explanation should then be included in the presentation itself, so that you don't necessarily have two documents. But otherwise, the explanation suffices, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I guess everything is understood. And also, just to clear things up, this new document that explains things thoroughly or make things easier, now going to serve as an addendum to the one that you had presented or tabled before the speaker, or the minister had tabled before the speaker. And then in our report, we'll also reflect on that, so that it's something that is taken, that is part of the work that we've been doing. Can we then proceed with the questions?
Thanks, Chairperson. May I respond to the questions as you ask them? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
The first question was from Dr. Kado, where he requested an update on the
price performance price preference system. The guidelines in respect of the PPS were published in 2015 to take account of the legal advice and public commentary that was received and approved by the Commission, on condition that the Department of Economic Development, of Economic Development Department, also approves. That document was sent to the Minister in August 2016, and we are still waiting for feedback from the Minister on that, or from the Department on that. So we respectfully ask that perhaps that question should be put to the Department as well, because we work with them, and we do. We are responsible for certain parts, they are responsible for certain parts. Thank you.
Maybe to make a follow-up on that, I think we are aware that the parts, it's only the trade and industry that is part of, and yourselves and the Department.
Yes.
So I think the reason why it's directed at you is because you get orders from both.
Yes.
So you are able then to give us the direct response.
Okay.
Mm. Are you not able to talk on that?
No, all I would say is that we, from our part, we have agreed that certain changes should be made as based on the comments that we have received. And we cannot finalize those changes unless we've got the consent of EDD. And we are there, we then passed those, what the commission has approved, what ITEC has approved, to EDD to say, this is our position, this is how we see things, can you please just consent? Or if you disagree, tell us what you think we should change. So
is the report going to be published afterwards?
Yes, it would have to be, because if for it to have effect, the industry and the users of the instrument must know. So yes, it will be published.
Are you satisfied, Doctor? Okay.
And then, yes, Mr. Pikinini asked how ITEC is progressing with the creation of rebates for downstream manufacturers on primary steel that is not locally manufactured. Let me just say right from the beginning that the interventions that were made with respect to steel were by design broad in order to protect as much of the primary steel sector of South Africa as possible. The thinking was then, to the extent that there are these products that we do not make, we will then grant rebates so that we don't make the mistake of opening up the market to the damaging imports for the duration of the remedy. So I am happy to announce that some of the rebates have already been implemented. Some were approved in the last commission meeting, and I think there's one or two that are still in the process of investigation. But we have already started work on, in fact, we've already done a lot of work on that.
I want us to make follow up so that we don't come back to the issues. If we're comfortable, we'll pass.
And another question which was tied to that was, how do we prevent dumping from happening? And if I go back to the earlier part of my presentation today, we've got this instrument called anti-dumping, which basically tries to make imports expensive in the South African market, expensive to the same degree that they are in the country of origin. So if this bottle in China is sold for 1 rand, in South Africa, when they export it to South Africa, they must also sell it to our local industry at 1 rand. If they sell it at 10 cents, then they are dumping, because our producers cannot match the price of 10 cents. They make a loss. So what you do then is to impose duties that cover the balance to push the price back to 1 rand, so that there's no unfair advantage that the Chinese exporter to South Africa has in relation to the South African producer. So the interventions we make are, the first one is, as I said, to impose provisional measures. So as quickly as possible after the investigation has been initiated, if there is a case, we then give interim relief. That lasts for up to 9 months. We then have to come up with the final relief, which takes into account all information that we are satisfied with, which then makes the anti-dumping duty permanent or final. And as I explained earlier, usually anti-dumping duties remain in place for 5 years. That's in terms of our law and in terms of our commitments to the World Trade Organization. They may be renewed, however, for another 5-year period if
the industry that's benefiting from it comes back to ISEC and says, hey, if you remove these duties, this problem is going to resume. This is the evidence we have. And if we are convinced, we then recommend that they stay in place for another 10 years, for another 5 years. So they work in that fashion. To give an example, for instance, with the steel wire rope and cables, which are basically the ropes that we rely on when we enter the lift and they pull the lift up or down, we've got massive duties that are in place against China there, and they've been in place for at least 10 years, if I'm not mistaken, maybe more, because the industry approached ITEC at the end of the first 5-year period to say the risk is still there, please extend the period by another 5 years. I hope that explains it. Thank you. To move on to the next question, Chairperson.
Yeah, but anti-dumping, maybe I should also ask this question that
yes.
We discussed earlier on. The, let's say customs confiscate goods that relate to that.
Yes.
At the borders, whatever border post that is there or post that is there. How do you ensure that that product is not then circulated after being confiscated?
I think, may I ask my colleague Dusane, who used to work for SARS, to take that question?
Chairperson, if I'm hearing you correctly, you are saying the SARS official at the port of entry confiscates the goods in a container, maybe carrying the goods that we've imposed anti-dumping duties. But there's quite a difference. You see, with the anti-dumping duties, we are not saying that the products are illegal. They are still allowed to come in. It's just that we want them to pay tax to make them more expensive in the South African market. But in most cases, the SARS official at the port of entry will confiscate goods that are illegal. For instance, counterfeits. If, for instance, it's a container full of branded sneakers, maybe Nike sneakers, and they will call someone, a brand manager from Nike, and they will check if it's not a counterfeit. And those are the ones that are confiscated at the port of entry.
So if I hear you well, you are saying even after imposing, if for instance the tax is paid after
yeah.
the goods are in the country.
No, they should be paid at the port of entry. You
exactly.
Yeah.
If they are not able to be paid, they need to be confiscated.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that is correct.
Yes.
That is correct.
So how to ensure that those goods, for instance, if they are not able to pay, they then normally they go to the warehouse.
Okay.
How to ensure that they are safe?
Okay, no, I hear you. Unfortunately for ITEC, we are not at the port of entry. So we rely on our counterpart SARS, and that they apply the legislation correctly there.
Can I just add, Chairperson,
yeah.
that we have the import-export department, which focuses on the type of infringements that Dumsane, my colleague Dumsane, has mentioned. But I don't think there is any reason why we couldn't request them to close the gap that we are identifying, Chairperson. I do think that Dumsane and I, since we started working together, had been having a conversation about coordinating more with other agencies, so that when our instruments are deployed, where we deploy them in coordination with other agencies and create sufficient profiles for importers to know that they are on the watch list. Yes,
I think that's very essential. Cooperation with other stakeholders, that especially for the, because we want to prevent such things from happening. We want to protect our country. So we can't do that if we just tick the box, because my work is done, and therefore if that person or that institution is not doing its work, then it's see, doesn't serve the purpose, because you are ticking the box. But does it help the country if that which you tick the box on is not really largely, you know, receiving the intended purpose? I'm covered with the response.
Thank you, Chair.
Any other? We're done. Okay. Proceed, Mr. Gentleman.
The next question was from the EFF, and the question was, why is ITEC waiting for the minister's response in its trade remedy investigations? This was in relation to the safeguard duties which were are currently under consideration in relation to imports of chicken from the European Union. I must mention, members, that this investigation is one of the unique ones in that it was conducted under the auspices of the Economic Partnership Agreement between the EU and South Africa. So the parameters that govern government actions are in terms of that bilateral agreement. And that agreement provides for the safeguard measures that South Africa wants to impose, but it also provides for a forum which involves other member states of the Southern African Customs Union, being Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, Swaziland, and South Africa, and obviously their counterparts in the EU. So when the minister makes a decision, i.e. the Minister of Trade and Industry in South Africa, which is the country that's moving with these safeguard duties, he then has to consult with his counterparts within the Southern African Customs Union and before the steel, the duties can be imposed. So where we are now is that the Minister of Trade and Industry is still consulting. The one thing that I should mention, though, is that there is some reprieve that the poultry industry is having because of avian flu, which has afflicted, I think, German and UK flocks. Sorry, Netherlands and Netherlands. And as a result, South Africa put in place measures to ban imports from those countries. So my sense is also that the minister doesn't really feel the sense of urgency because there is in any event low levels of imports from those countries for now.
Okay. The member is not here to make a follow-up. We may proceed if there's no follow-up on the question.
Thank you, Chairperson. The next question was from Mr. Tliani, who asked, why was there no import duty on maize and yet there are duties of 42% on sugar and 24% on wheat, respectively? This is simply because the nature of the tariffs we have on these three products is based on a formula. And how the formula works is that because South African producers of these commodities, let's talk maize, which is what you've asked about, have to compete with imported maize. When the maize price drops a lot internationally, we are then forced to drop our prices here in South Africa. Sometimes that is good for the consumer. But it can also be bad for the farmers, can also be bad for the millers. So what we then put in place was a mechanism which is based on the international reference price of maize, which works as follows. When the international prices are high, which is when South African farmers are able to or producers are able to compete, then the duty goes to zero because the prices are high. But when the prices go down to dangerous levels, then the duties increase to try and protect our producers from those imports. So the duties will then vary. Sometimes they'll go up, for instance, as you can see with the sugar there at 42%.
And sometimes they will go down when the global prices are high to zero, as is the case with maize. You may be aware now that we've got an issue with sugar imports. And we are currently processing an application from the sugar producers to try and protect them, because even the 42% is proving not sufficient. What we are thinking about at the moment, and we are not going to do it in the short term, but it's something that we are applying our minds to, is the possibility of having some sort of floor, and I know this, some sort of minimum protection that is in place all the time. It won't be too high as to prejudice the consumers or the buyers of the finished goods, but it might just be there so that we are not completely exposed in dire situations such as we have, for instance, now with sugar. That thinking is still pretty much in its formative stages. The senior manager for tariffs in agricultural products has put together a team to do some thinking around that and having a conversation around that. But the short answer, and that is that we are at zero because our duty is designed to fluctuate. Thank you.
Are you covered to that extent? Okay. I'll actually follow up on this one later. You may proceed.
We had a question from Mema Timbi, whether there was anything wrong with South African chickens for us to be having to import chicken. My short answer is I actually love South African chicken. There is nothing wrong with... can I say that anymore with the listeriosis? ordinarily speaking, no, there's nothing wrong. The standards that the industry observes in producing chicken is as good as you get, if not, in fact, in some instances, our monitoring is better than the US. So our chicken is really very good. Why do we import chicken? Well, there are two reasons. The first one is it's imported on a dump basis. If I speak specifically about the nature of the product that you consume in South Africa, we South Africans like what is called brown meat, chicken with bone in it, thighs, wings. We don't like boneless chicken, the chest, or the breast, as they call it. Exactly the opposite is the case, for instance, in Europe. They like breast, and bone-in chicken, or what brown chicken, they don't really like it. And so they just try to get rid of it, which is why they then sell it in markets like ours at an extremely low price, basically a byproduct or waste material price. And obviously then there are people who are then interested in that, and then they want to buy it and outcompete our local farmers. So that's basically the short answer to that. That is why we then come in with the instruments that we have to try and level the playing field.
Thank you for the response. Mem Pulo has a follow-up question.
Yes, I have a follow-up question. I think you answered it slightly.
Okay. At least it's moving, Chair. My question is around when you say because they don't eat that, it comes with a lower price. What I wanted to understand is to say, are you also using the sample that you used to say you level the playing field in terms of the pricing?
And my question is around to say why, that's for me, from my personal, why do we have to take people from other countries that we've got? You know, I'm just asking that, what are we saying as South Africans in terms of that? Because we've got that, it's just something that says we don't have it. Now, why do we take it? Do we take it because our people are hungry? Or do we take it that because our people will just eat what they're given to? What was the rationale behind that? Thank you. I think that question is beyond your decision, but I'm just asking it. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, ma'am. Follow me, Matembe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would venture two answers. The first one is that the nature of the product, that chicken is the cheapest available form of protein, and particularly frozen chicken, it's a commodity. It's almost like it's almost like petrol. You buy the cheapest petrol you can find, and particularly in the lowest income segment of the South African population. So there's, I would say, a ready market which is ready to, which is willing to buy that product purely based on price. The second part of the question is a legal one. We can't ban imports. It is in the nature of the agreements or the commitments that we have made under the WTO that we will allow for free trade subject to our ability to react when imports become harmful to our domestic producers of competing products. So that's more of a political economy type response than a consumer response.
That's related to our foreign policy issues, I guess, and the fact that ratification normally by parliament happens after, agreements have been signed by government. So these are some of the challenges or issues that we've been complaining about as the legislature.
The last question I have, Chairperson, was about the fact that there was only one woman in the ITEC delegation, and how many females are there in the organization. I must apologize again, Chairperson, that the delegation again today has got only one woman. It's not a reflection of the demographics at ITEC. In fact, if I just take you back here, if you look at that organogram, you see that most of our senior managers are female. Rika, who's with us here, Tariff Investigations, responsible for agriculture and others. Nomonde Somdaga, Tariff Investigations too, responsible for a very important program, the Automotive Production Development Program and other matters. All the steel matters are handled by Nomonde. Zoleka Kwabendini, who is running with Trade Remedies 1, anti-dumping, countervailing, and safeguards. And Karina Fantirin, who's also running with Trade Remedies 2. The only male is Marius Collins. This is in the core business. On the corporate side, which is not reflected here, if it is, I don't know where it is, our CFO is a female. So we, oh yes, and our head of HR is also a woman. So we are not short on women. Maybe next time I'll ask one of them to represent me and I'll stay at home.
No, I think the reflection is on the delegation.
Yeah.
Because the CFO is responsible for finances. Was she not supposed to be part of you here? That's I think the main concern that how you compose your delegation is very important. And thanks for that information. I think it helps. We've been to ITEC as a committee. We've seen that you do have women. The challenge was the women. What percentage do they form in terms of your executive management?
Mm.
Yes. That was the other I think.
Members, I think I need to indicate here also that we have representatives from the sugar industry. Last time at least
I did introduce Adina. Today Adina is joined by Mr. Mahlala. They are all from representing associations dealing with land reform for farmers and also small-scale farmers. Adira. Thank you so much. They are very interested in this, but at the same time, trade and industry is dealing with the sugar industry issue today. I think they will also, I think it's much more beneficial to be there than here. Because here we're just dealing with the issues of tariffs, and there they're dealing with broader issues. Yes. Thank you so much for showing keen interest in the work that we're doing. Okay, you may proceed.
Chairperson, I've gone through the full list of questions that were asked in the last session.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think the other issue was the impact of your work.
Oh, yes.
And also, I think also Shonyane raised the issue of glossary of terms.
Sorry,
what? It is your acronyms.
Oh, yes.
You're dealing with acronyms, but you don't have somewhere where you explain that. And then I think they are crying foul, especially on the issue of tariffs regarding emerging farmers. Because they are saying in few years to come, the very near future, they will be within the sugar industry. You won't find farmers, especially the small-scale farmers and the emerging farmers.
Chairperson, thanks for those 3 points. Let me perhaps respond to all of them. The issue around the impact of our work, I unfortunately don't have pictures here, but I would say the first point that you see is the reduction in imports. So if you look at the import statistics, you see that once we have deployed one instrument or another, if it is effective, the imports will reduce. This has been the case in point, for instance, with regard to primary steel, where imports have reduced. So much so that Evra's Highveld Steel, which, as most of us will remember, actually stopped producing, particularly structural steel, has resumed operations and has re-employed 400 of the workers that were previously retrenched. And that is because of the intervention that we made in the form of customs tariffs as well as safeguards. So that's one example I'm able to give. As regards the issue of sugar, the application that is before us, Chairperson, let me firstly mention that I've met Adila and Mamadala. I met Adila firstly at our previous session here, but they both traveled all the way to Pretoria, and we had a meeting. We, together with Manini Makarina, I mean, Rika wasn't there, but Manini Masitela and the team that is working on sugar, Manini was representing the team that is working on sugar, together with myself. And the
The long and short of it is that they agree that it is very important and urgent that stronger relief be given to the sugar industry. I did mention to them that on the fluctuating duty, there is a trigger that has already kicked in, which we expect will raise the duty, I think, by more than 10%, if I'm not mistaken, but it's making its way through. Where are we on that, Rika?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. It will increase from 42% to 55%.
And that is in the ordinary course. And then the second intervention is based on the latest application that SAFTA and SASA have brought to make that instrument more sensitive. In other words, to enable the duties to kick in much earlier than they do now, in terms of from a price reference point of view. And I explained even there that we are handling that application with as expeditiously as possible. So the other issue then that Mr. Madala raised was the issue of reciprocal commitments and the issues of transformation around the sugar industry. He gave us a presentation, and we took note of it, but we also mentioned that the application as it stands has got reciprocal commitments. And as the investigation progresses, we invite them to supplement or to provide further input formally through the investigation process, so that that input also sits with the Commission.
What do you mean by that reciprocal?
What we do now, Chairperson, particularly with tariff instruments that we give, is that we try to use it as an instrument that not only protects the bottom line of companies, but also produces certain transformational outcomes, i.e. public interest outcomes. So when Mr. Madala approached us, he was saying that it is important that in granting relief in respect of the present application, particular attention should be paid to the plight of small and medium-sized farmers, which are represented by his organization, the SAFTA. So basically, the reciprocal commitments then are what you, as an industry or as a beneficiary of the instrument, give to society in exchange for the remedy that we will avail to you, or we recommend that you get.
I think it's important when you respond, you respond from, you know, so that even a lay person can understand. It's very, very important, not only for people seated here, but for everybody else who wants to hear. Thank you so much. The last one?
Is the last question is acronyms, Chairperson. I think it falls into the same category as what you have just said now, that we are not talking to ourselves, we're talking to a wider audience. So we will make sure that going forward, not only, we provide a glossary of terms. I think it's a separate page, that's probably easier. Yeah.
We will then give you an opportunity to, there was a question on the update on SACO, remember? Last time we requested that you give us an update on SACO.
SACO?
Yeah. No, I think it was the minister, not yourself. It was you then. Yeah. No, it's yourself. Yeah.
The renegotiation of the SACO agreement, or what?
No, remember you were you providing administration for SACO.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
We just wanted an update in terms of who's involved and.
Yes.
And because of this new development also as pronounced. Where do we stand? What is the actual, what is actually happening around the administration as such?
Chairperson, thank you. As I mentioned earlier, the Southern African Customs Union, SACU for short, is comprised of South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. As it happens, it's the oldest customs union in the world. Throughout its existence, I think it came into existence in 1910 or 1909, thereabout. 1910. South Africa has conducted, the essential feature of the customs union is that the member countries apply what is called a common external tariff. So if you agree that you're going to have duties of 42% on sugar, whether sugar enters the region from Walvis Bay in Namibia or it enters from Durban in South Africa, the same duty will apply, 42%. And then the second feature about the customs union is that the money that is collected from the duties is then allocated to the members of the union in terms of what's called the revenue sharing formula. I won't go into the details of the formula. Suffice it to say that each country then gets a portion of the money that's collected. The third function, the third thing is that, is the administration of the work, whether it's tariffs or trade remedies or import-export. By agreement amongst SACU members, ITEC is responsible for performing the administration on behalf of all member states. In terms of the latest SACU agreement, which was concluded in 2002, ITEC would continue whilst other members develop their own capacity. Unfortunately, there hasn't been much progress on that front in terms of other member states. So the region then agreed that South Africa will continue to perform that work. We are currently involved in the renegotiation of the SACU agreement. That process is led by the DTI. We only make input from a technical point of view, but the political decisions and the nature of the changed agreement will come through the Department of Trade and Industry. Ricardo, if you have got anything you want to add there? Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, there's an outcry that we pay more than we can afford. There's over-reliance in South Africa in terms of, you're talking about the formula. Do we apply that formula, for instance, when we have to assist our SACU member state?
Chairperson, the people who are more best placed to answer that question are Treasury. That said, the last time I don't know if you had the meeting where the Treasury made a presentation on the revenue formula. I know that there are some proposed changes, but the last time I attended the meeting on SACU, the revenue formula had improved substantially in terms of reflecting the individual members' contribution to the common revenue pool. So we may still be paying more than our fair share, but it's an improvement on what used to be the case in the past. But I should also mention, and at the risk of delving into the political arena, Chairperson, one of the advantages that South Africa has in contributing more than its fair share of revenue is that it is then able to have its way in respect of tariff policy and other policies. So, for instance, one of the difficulties that or challenges that we have now with sugar is that Namibia and Botswana are not entirely happy with the duties because they want cheap sugar. And Swaziland in South Africa, we've got vulnerable farmers who want to protect their sugar farm. So what the revenue sharing formula is able to do, or has that's why I've been able to assist South Africa with, is to enable it to say, well, guys, in any event, we still compensate you for some of the disadvantage that the, you know, that may suffer as a result of our implementation of our policies. And it, that's also important because in South Africa, tariffs are used as an instrument for industrial to drive industrial policy. So we want to use them to try and boost manufacturing. For other members of SACU, that instrument is a revenue raising mechanism. It's just a tax to, for the government to have money. It, it doesn't translate into a structural change in the economy.
I'm asking that question to you specifically because you know policy changes are influenced by implementers. Whatever that policymakers normally do has to respond to challenges you mentioned as implementers. So it's very important. I deliberately did that so that you could talk to us about challenges that you might, because sometimes even officials, you know, yes. they complain that we are made to do this because of, you see, and
yes.
at the end of the day, last time actually the former chair or chief commissioner complained that they have to do that work irrespective of administration work takes a lot of money. Because you have to also apply human resource there, you have
yes.
to put in a lot of resources financially also. So that on its own is a burden
yes.
on South Africa because nobody wants to take responsibility. So it's high time that you just talk open some of these things to us so that we understand for us to be able to influence.
Yes.
But if we don't know, we won't be able to. So when we give you such platform, you do that. It only serves you in return. Yes, we could easily also ask the minister because the minister has a political response to that. You would have an administrative response to that too. So that then concludes our interaction with you. Thank you so much. I think you. Just as a reminder that please remember that whatever information that you're sharing with us, document that you produce, is not only meant for us here, it's meant for the entire public. So with this document, the public gets educated on the work that we're doing. With this document, the public are able to give feedback to us so that we can improve on also the bettering, you know, the policy and legislation side. So it's important that we use them also as part of education, but also as part of encouraging the public to interact with us. So the issue of outreach is of utmost importance. How high tech, you know, reach out to the public is also very, very important. Don't just use this platform to reach out. I think you need also to develop your own instruments or your own ways of reaching out to the people so that you can be known. You are taken as a very technical institution, but you might be surprised how people are interested in the work that you're doing. Or how people are affected by the work that you're doing, but do not know where to go to in order to get assistance. So it's important that whatever work you do, especially on behalf of the public, that you reach out to them, back to them, so that they also tend to understand the work you are doing, and they are able to also give you feedback. It's what we will appeal to you to do so that you do like what Competition Commission also highly technical, but they were able then to change the situation. Now everybody can talk to the competition issues because of the slots that they've requested in various community radio stations, in the national radio stations, and the papers, and so forth, so that you reach out to them. They understand the work of the. They might even help you on the issues of the things that are being taken or confiscated at the border. You might get a tip off Otherwise, thank you so much for coming back to us and responding to our questions for clarity. We can only wish you well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Member.
Okay. Members, our meeting with the department will be in the next 5 to 10 minutes. May we break now for tea? There's no fresh tea.
Make a noise. So the meeting is like a happy, happy. Thank you. Good morning. Can you pass this to your delegation? So that to be easier for your people to find the next page. Thank you.
country.
Very much. May we come back again? Let's welcome the department under the leadership of the minister, the deputy minister. You're mostly welcome today to deal with the last part of your APP, which is the finances, the financial, the budget of the for the year. I think this is an opportunity to interact on the budget. Thank you so much. I see the DG, and I think two ladies that I'm not sure whether I'm familiar with. Okay. Let me also welcome Lomi Vuma, who's the chairperson of the NPO by the name of Make Sense Foundation. He just came to observe the our deliberations in the meeting. You welcome, Mr. Vuma.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think you know all the members. Minister, there's no new member after the last meeting we had with you. We are still intact. May I then, without any waste of time, hand over to you for any presentation. You can hand over to whoever must do the presentation then.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and a warm good morning to members of the committee. I was in Gauteng and I was told yesterday that I can expect 5 days of rain. And I landed this morning and saw the rain has not yet come in the quantities of water that we need, but a warm good morning. Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity. And before I start, if I may just introduce the delegation. I think most of the faces here are old faces, in the sense that you've seen them before, not necessarily old in any other sense. But, of course, Sulu, the committee knows very, very well. She's the PLO, of course. Next to Sulu is Irshad Kathrada. He's the special advisor in the ministry, and I introduced him last time. Len Verwees, a senior researcher, economist in the department, and has done quite a bit of interesting work on the trade issue that we share from time to time. And I don't know, Chair, if you thought Tshepo Tshwane is one of the new faces. He's been around for a while in the department, but I don't think we bring him that often to the committee. And he's a manager in the office of the Director General. And then, of course, my colleague, who is also a member of Parliament, myself. Next to me, you know, the DG. And then sitting next to the DG, I think she may have been here before, but she's the star of today. So it's Irene Ramaphosa, and Irene is the CFO of EDD. And she comes from the office of the Auditor General. And to get a young chartered accountant coming to cut the teeth in government and in the department is always a good thing. And we hope a stay will be a pleasant and productive stay for government. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Chairperson. I understand that the purpose of today's briefing is to complete the presentation that we did previously on the APP, where we provided the committee with the strategic, operational, and KPI elements of the annual performance plan of the department. We provided financial information, but the committee noted that because of time, it would be useful to have an additional opportunity to provide and discuss the financials of the department. And that gave us an opportunity also to expand the presentation a little bit, to provide a bit more detail than we would in the summary of the APP. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask the DG and the CFO to do most of the presentation, but I thought I should just warm them up a little bit by starting on recalling the role of the department, established in 2009. Slide 3 contains the core mandate that the members of the committee are familiar with, but also that its responsibilities to oversee entities such as certain DFIs, strategic direction to regulators, the competition and trade, and provide technical and secretarial support services to the technical unit of the PICC. Parliament appropriated the total budget for 2018-19. The budget proposals amounted to 1.1 billion rand. And I will come back to this in a moment, but the EDD component was 139.7 million. So let's round it and say roughly 140 million rand of that money goes to the department. The rest goes to the entities. The transfers to the entities amount to just short of a billion rand, 932.9 million rand. And on the next slide, we indicate that we are the instrument through the budget vote of economic development for a number of entities. The entities, some of the entities get their money pretty much exclusively from the department through the budget vote. Others don't receive all of the income, so the mechanism differs, and I'll come back to that. And perhaps what I should do is to go straight to slide number 6, which is really the interesting slide. So what this slide shows is if we break down the budget that Parliament votes on, and we split it into entities, we've got 2, 4, 6, 8, let's call it destinations of the funding. The Competition Commission gets the single biggest share, that's 26% of the budget. Now the Competition Commission has two sources of funding. The main source of funding is the vote of Parliament. A smaller but not insignificant source of funding comes from users of the Commission in mergers and acquisitions. Users pay a filing fee And committee members will recall that last year I gazetted an increase in the filing fee and reported that to the committee. So the commission then is responsible. They've got their own accounting officer. So the DG of EDD is only indirectly responsible for that. The commissioner then accounts for the spending of the monies of the Competition Commission. We've had an arrangement for a number of years with National Treasury that enables us to roll over any reserves that the Commission has. So in good years it builds up a reserve, and in years of high expenditure it draws on that reserve. So for example, when you do a major market inquiry, like the healthcare inquiry, very expensive, then you draw on your reserves. And then you hope that you have go through a period when your expenditure is not so high and you can rebuild your reserves a little bit. The second one is the Tirisano Fund. That's a new baby. And the Tirisano Fund accounts for 23% of the budget vote. But the Tirisano Fund is a strange baby in the sense that the money comes through Treasury and the National Revenue Fund, but it doesn't come from Treasury. It's money paid by the construction companies that were implicated in the cartel many years ago, 2010. And just to recall very briefly what happened. We took them to the competition authorities. They were given a penalty of 1.4 billion rand. And after the penalty was imposed by the competition tribunal, we went back to them and said, but hang on, the state also overpaid as a result of your collusion. And in any event, if you want to start on a new slate, you've got to do a reparation agreement with the state. A lot of negotiation. They said, look, we don't believe the state overpaid. They compared their costs with Brazil, Stadia, and so on. But in the end, after a long negotiation, they reached an agreement with us. I'm not going to recall the whole agreement, Chairperson, but I'll only recall one element. They agreed that they would put 1.5 billion rand into a special fund. That fund would be used, and they would pay installments every year, and that fund would be used for transformation, to help pay for the training of black artisans, black engineers, maths and science at schools in townships, support for small businesses with working capital, small infrastructure like a rural bridge where the kids can cross the river going to school in the morning, a few things like that. And the initial intention was that that money would go into a fund that's co-managed between government and the construction industry. But then given all the challenges that there were around, let's call it by its name, corruption and state capture in the past, we wanted to create belts and braces to make sure that there's every control over these funds. And we thought, let it be transparent and open, let the money flow via the National Revenue Fund, which means there's always parliamentary oversight. So nobody, no minister colluding with others can keep that money hidden, that one would shine the torchlight on it. So the first monies have come through to Treasury and from there to EDD. And the trustees are now busy evaluating projects, and because they now have built up enough of a sum, they're going to be able to make the first commitments, because these commitments are multi-year commitments, so you need to know that you've got reserves to cover the obligations that arise, and you don't rely completely on the future flow of funds from the contributors. So that's the Tirisano Fund. Next is CIFA, the Small Enterprise Finance Agency. Now CIFA accounts for 21% of the budget. And we should put next to CIFA, there should be a bracket saying via IDC. So let's quickly recall the CIFA story. I know most members know this, but apologies to those who've been through this before. But CIFA is an amalgamation, a merger of a number of small business entities. We had Kula, some of others like that in the past. We amalgamated them, circa 2012, thereabouts, and created a single institution inside the state to avoid this duplication where you have multiple CEOs and offices and cars and so on. And then we had a challenge. The IDC legal mandate also covers small business. CIFA's legal mandate covers small business. So we said, let's make a wholly owned subsidiary of the IDC. And that was a simple and uncomplicated arrangement. In 2014, the president created a new ministry, the Small Business Ministry. And the question then became, what happens to CIFA? In discussions between the executive authorities, it was agreed we keep CIFA as a wholly owned subsidiary of the IDC, but that we shift political oversight to the Minister of Small Business Development, with the Minister of Economic Development having a residual right to appoint one board member, and the IDC having the right to appoint, if I recall, two board members. So now the question is, every year Treasury makes a grant to CIFA. That grant is to cover CIFA's operating costs as well as to fund the small business lending program. That money, as in the first year or two, has gone to EDD, and then EDD made an arrangement with the IDC. It goes into the IDC. The IDC then disperses it on an as-needs basis to CIFA. And the reason for that arrangement is that the IDC's financial systems and controls are more robust and stronger. When the Small Business Ministry was created, EDD offered, in fact, I requested that the grant should be paid by the Small Business Portfolio Committee budget, not the Economic Development budget. And Treasury felt that they are more comfortable for now with the existing arrangement and that we can reopen it in future. Either way, the destination is the IDC, who in turn must then disperse to CIFA. So that's the CIFA story in brief. The next one is the department itself. The department accounts for 13% of the total budget that is approved by the by Parliament and voted on by Parliament. And that 13% covers both the department staff, the ministry staff, and all the costs related to ministry and department. Next one is ITAC. ITAC is a pretty straightforward one. It's the Trade Commission, and they account for 10% of the budget. The Competition Tribunal. The Tribunal is a quasi-judicial body. So we have oversight of it, but only strategic oversight. The actual work, day-to-day work, is done on more of a judicial standard that's applied. In other words, they're an adjudicative body that conduct their affairs without executive authority direction on any of the specific issues. But they fall within our stable, and between the Commission and the Tribunal, the two of them together through our budget provide the technical support to the Competition Appeal Court. So the CAC don't technically fall within the remit of the Minister of Economic Development. It falls within the remit of the Minister of Justice because it's part of our court system. And incidentally, it is the highest court in the country on competition matters, save for the Constitutional Court. Parliament passed an amendment to the Constitution a number of years ago that means appeals of the Competition Appeal Court no longer go to the Supreme Court of Appeal. So the Competition Tribunal accounts for 3% of the total budget. Then there's the Steel Development Fund that was created and announced last year. They account for 3% of the budget too. And that is, says also via IDC. That money is indirectly, not as directly as construction, slightly more indirectly, it's indirectly from a big fine that was imposed on ArcelorMittal. When the fine was imposed, I think it was 1.5 billion, it's the biggest fine to a single company, we reached an agreement with Treasury that a portion of that fine, about 100 million initially, would come to the development of the steel industry on the grounds that ArcelorMittal's actions had undermined downstream steel users. So we wanted to put something back into the industry. And Treasury grants about 30 million a year. It comes then to EDD and we transfer to the IDC. The IDC then more than matches this. So the IDC puts in a significant additional sum for the steel development fund that we've reported previously to the committee. And the two together is then intended to help the steel industry. The final one is the PICC. There's a PICC technical secretariat made up of engineers and planners and specialists, and they get funded via the budget. The money goes to the IDC, who in turn houses the technical unit. So as an example, and I should keep it for another occasion, but I'm tempted just to give the example, given the absence of heavy rain today. When Cape Town had a water crisis last year, the city of Cape Town approached us to ask, can we make technical people available? So we took one of the country's foremost water specialists who was on our books in the PICC, and we seconded him a few days a month to work with the city of Cape Town. Very recently, Ian Nielsen wrote to me again asking, can we extend that period for another couple of months, because they found his work and the contribution he's made to be enormously helpful to the city in managing its water supply issues. So that's an example of the kind of things that come from the PICC technical facility. That accounts for 1% of the total budget. Now what honorable members would have seen is that there's no IDC line item. IDC is referred to, but it's more that the IDC manages certain funds for us. And that is because since 1994, in fact, even well before 1994, we haven't put a cent as government through the fiscus into the IDC. The model with the IDC is we expect the IDC to use its capital base to generate profit that is then reinvested into its development mandate. And the reason for doing that is in 1994 and onwards, we've had such enormous pressure with housing, education, healthcare, social grants and others, that in the annual balancing of the books, the view that we took as government is, as long as the IDC can manage with its existing model, let's direct the resources to other purposes. But I raise that because there are other countries that have different models. Brazil, for example, which has got one of the better functioning development finance models, have a monthly contribution similar to our UIF that is paid into their DFI. And that means that they can provide a lot more resources available. But that's why the IDC portfolio is what it is. You see a legacy portfolio, so they have some blue chip investments, and then they have, call it the real economy, greenfields portfolio, where they're backing startups, new businesses, new investment, and so on. So that gives us just over a billion rand, as we indicated, that is the budget of the economic development portfolio, with the sums set out in the second column in rand terms, but I've taken the committees through the percentages. So, Jay, that's a bird's-eye view of how the budget comes together. And with your permission, I'd like to give over to the DG, who I know may also ask the CFO to assist where appropriate, to take the committee through a further breakdown of the budget. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, Minister, Deputy Minister, and colleagues around here, thank you very much. What I'll do, dear Chairperson, I'll actually give details of the budget allocations to the overview that the Minister has just made on the big numbers, and also the context in which he placed those numbers in. Now, if you look at that slide, you would actually see that the department has got three programs as such on the right, on the left hand side, and also on the right hand side it will actually give the APP, in other words the number of KPIs that we have. In fact, those KPIs are about 23 KPIs that we drive in the department, and also we've got about 182 products. Right. Now, those programs, you see that the objectives that they are trying to actually to achieve are actually listed there to ensure the, under the program one is to ensure the good governance right within the department itself. And program number two, that is the administration program. That's where you would find the ministry, you will find the office of the DG, you will find the CFO, you will find the corporate services in there. And then in program number two, right, it will be a program that actually coordinates job drivers within the responsibility of within the economy. Now, also to facilitate the social dialogue. Now, the program number three, right, as such, that's where, as Minister was saying, that that's where the monitoring and oversight of entities actually is. Now, if you look at that slide, you see that slide is actually to give the big picture of the allocation. As I was indicating that, we have got three programs there, and those three programs, they actually are funded. The funding takes about 13% of the allocation within the department. If you look at the breakdown of that program, you see that the biggest percentage within the department is about 8% of the total allocation. Right, it will be in the administration. The others is 3% and the 2% respectively for program number two and program number three. As Minister was saying that the big bulk of our allocation, 87% of it are the transfers. That is still also the big picture, but that big picture now we are analyzing it in terms of the economic classification to indicate how much do we have set aside for the compensation of employees. Right, which is about 90 million. If you take for the whole budget, it will be 8% of the total budget. But that is the biggest allocation that we have in the department, which is 90 million, and goods and services about 44 million. Now, if I were to take the program number one, Chairperson, you will see that the program number one, in terms of the functions, it is the ministry, as I indicated, it is the office of the Director General, it's the corporate management services, and the CFO's, that is the financial management, or the CFO's office. Now, the allocation there, Chairperson, is as 28% for the ministry and 13% for the office of the director general and 43% for the corporate services of the department. And that program, as indicated there at the bottom, is more about ensuring there is a governance. And I was looking at the system, how the system and the processes within the department are actually functioning. Now, those are actually measured in terms of the two KPIs that are there and two products. Now, that is still program number one, but there is that analysis is in terms of the economic classifications. The compensation of employees within that program, you see that it forms the big portion of that program, because mainly those are people who will be within the program number one. About 50% of that allocation, it actually goes to paying off their salaries. Program number two, Chairperson, you see that it has got two functions, right? One is about growth, the new growth path, right? And also the job drivers and the social dialogue. Right? Now, in the main, right, the biggest allocation there is within the new growth path. It's about 65% of the budget. Now, in terms of the economic classification, right, that program too, if you look at it, mainly, Chairperson, it is about the salaries, because that's where is the bulk of our staff is in program number two. It's about 94% of that allocation. Program number three, Chairperson, as we indicated earlier on, that in the main, it is about the transfers that we make. Right? Now, the total allocation of that program is 951 million. Right? But in, for instance, if you look at the first function, the development, investment, and industrial funding, that is where the support, the transfers that we make to the IDC, the support that we get here from the IDC. There we actually, the total amount is about 263, but that amount is not the full amount, it's not all that amount goes to IDC, right? But there are also officials within the department who are within that function itself, but we've also included the amount that we actually transfer to the IDC. Now, the next function there, that's where you would have the Competition Commission, the ITEC, and also the Competition Tribunal, right? Their transfer will be within that function, but it will also be amount that goes towards the financing of the salaries to perform some of those KPIs that are listed there under objective number 4, number 5, and number 6. Now, the last function there is the infrastructure, right, that goes through the PICC, right, and the officials, the staff that is responsible, that is attached to perform that function at the PICC. That slide, Chairperson, again, it's economic classification, which just indicates how many people are attached to that program. As you will see that at the bottom there, right, in the transfers and subsidies, the amount that is transferred as transfer to entities is 932 million, right, which is the bulk. But the remainder, it will be the money that is set aside for the officials who are actually attached to make sure that that function, right, at the entities is actually monitored. And their salaries is about 50 million, right, the staff there, that is the biggest cost there that we have for the department itself in monitoring those entities. Now, those were the allocations, Chairperson, that were actually allocation to the different programs, but in that slide, I'm more talking about the allocation in the next MTEF. You see that in the next MTEF, we've actually set aside 78.9% of our transfers in the next 3 years will actually be about that 80% the transfer. Now, if you look at the commission, if you look at the competition commission, you will see that the biggest chunk of the allocation there are the what is compensation of employees. That's about, we see that in the next 3 years, it will actually form about 62%, that is 61.6%, would go to the compensation within the Competition Commission. And also, if you look at that bullet number three is actually talking about what the Competition Commission will be doing, right, in terms of the market inquiries, right? We have set amount aside for the market inquiries, the private healthcare and the data, and the retail, the grocery retail sector. There we have also allocated amount for that into the future. Now, but of course, Competition Commission has got the investigations on the cartels, and there we've actually set aside an amount of about 241.3 million, right, in the MTEF. Mm-hmm. The Competition Tribunal, Chairperson, this year, yes, we've actually allocated about 35 million, but however, if you look at the next 3 years, you will see that we have actually allocated about 66.7, right, percent of the total revenue of the Competition Commission as 111 million in the next 3 years. Now, the other resource that they will get it from the filing of fees, right? The biggest cost, again, in the competition tribunal is in the compensation of employees, which will actually cost about 58.3%, which is about 102 in the next MTF. ITEC is another entity, Chairperson. You see that we have actually set aside 263.6 million of their total budget for the next 3 years, which makes about 78% of the allocation in the next 3 years. The bullet number three there, Chairperson, is actually talking about the investigations that the activities that they will be involved in the next 3 years, that is the investigations into the tariffs and also the permits, rebates and drawbacks. as a minister indicated there, as such in the IDC we don't make allocations in there, but IDC assists us in actually oversighting, for instance, the oversighting and supporting some activities. One of those activities is the CIFA, right? The CIFA, Chairperson, you actually see that the allocation in the MTF, we're actually looking at 725 million, right, in the next 3 years will be allocated to the CIFA. But of course, CIFA itself is actually focusing on the direct lending, and in the next 3 years in that direct lending, there is, they have set aside about an amount of about 170, which will grow up to about 225 million during the MTF. And also the other big activity that they have is the wholesale lending. And all that is actually supported by the IDC, right? But of course, even the department itself is involved there to actually to oversight, to work with the IDC in oversighting the CIFA. The PICC, Chairperson, as Minister actually indicated, that it is under the IDC, right? But we do have employees who are actually seconded into the CIFA, and themselves, that is the CIFA, is actually supporting that national infrastructure plan. That's where they have got about 18 strategic integrated projects. Now, under that program, they also do a lot of unblocking of infrastructure projects, ranging from regulatory challenges that are there, and also in engaging with the municipalities themselves. Now, we are actually looking at in the next MTF to actually to allocate an amount of about 45.8 million. That under this, the IDC Chairperson, there's also the Steel Development Fund, right? Remember that we said we allocated about 30 million this year for that fund. Now, last year we did transfer about 30 million, and also this current year we'll do the same thing, and even next year we'll a little bit up that amount to about 35 million. I will not go into the details of what the fund is. The minister did give the background into that. The Tirisano Fund, the minister said that it's a new fund, right? This year we have got an amount of about 240 million, which will actually be transferred to that fund. But the objectives of it are actually laid down there, just to summarize, Chairperson, is actually to transform the construction industry, and also to provide some funding for bursaries, and also to assist public schools in terms of raising the level of mathematics and science. Now, in terms of the MOA that we have signed between ourselves and IDC, in that we have actually outlined who are the players, right, who would be involved in that fund. Now, one player is ourselves as EDD. Our responsibilities are actually outlined there, now, which is actually just to oversee that fund is performing the functions as intended in terms of the MOA, and also we report to, we are expected by the National Treasury to report on the performance of the entity itself. But the other party there, which is the IDC, themselves, they are actually advising the trustees of the fund, and then at the same time they also account for the fund, for the funds that we have actually transferred. There was at some stage they need to, at a regular basis, a quarterly basis, they actually provide us with how that fund is actually performing. At the end of the financial year, they must actually prepare the financial statements. And also, of course, the disbursement, or a disbursement of those funds. The other party that is there, right, who actually is involved in the drafting of the business plan are the trustees, right? And those trustees themselves, they have got a responsibility to make sure that they set the policy and the ensure and the objectives and strategy of that fund. Yeah, that is the responsibilities of the trustees themselves, and of course making sure that the disbursements that have been set aside, they are doing what was intended. In conclusion, Chairperson, the budget itself is actually allocated to make sure that the mandate that we have set for ourselves as a department is actually met, and we do that in a number of ways, right, and also through the entities. Now, over the MTF, we actually were also looking at strengthening, right, the involvement of the department into the provincial economic development, right? Because we believe that it's important that the national departments that we coordinate, they also participate directly into the plans that are there in the in at the provincial level, the APP. Right? Now, at the last point, Chairperson, there is that you will ensure with such allocation that we mitigate the impact of the directives of we mitigate the impact of the cabinet approved budgetary reductions because of the pressures that are there, right, would actually ensure that all our entities, even ourselves, we stay within the reductions that are there. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, both the Minister and the DG, for this very in-depth, actually, presentation. I think we all understand what the department is all about now, and as far as finances are concerned, and just to support the APP.
114 plus 20.
The product is 182.
No, not product, but KPIs.
23.
KPIs are 24. Products are 206. Am I wrong?
Products are 23.
Products. 24.
20.
Products. 182. And then the KPIs is 23.
Where did I go wrong? 18 plus 2. 18 plus 18. 26. Which is for. 18 plus 8, 26, which is, and 20 plus 26, 46. Then 114 plus 26, plus 14.
You are counting products, Chairperson?
Yes, I'm counting products. I want to be sure.
We say there are 182. Are you getting something different?
Yes, somebody must do the right calculation, unless I'm not. My mathematics is no longer right.
Start here. 2 and 18, that's 20. That's 20. Plus 8, that's 28.
Oh, I
left. Plus 114.
Oh.
That's 142.
Oh, 2, 6 minus 18. Okay. Now I understand.
26, 158. Plus 14,
182. Yeah, no, I added the wrong one. 18. No, that's fine. It's my mistake. Okay. Thank you so much. And you are saying how many KPIs? 23. Okay, thanks so much. I just wanted to be sure so that we're on the same wavelength. Now you helped me, thanks. Members, here are the figures. Not just figures, but also related products and KPIs. Do you want to say anything? Dr. Pardo?
Thanks, Chair. I just wanted to ask about the allocation of the MTEF to the competition authorities and whether, given what's proposed in the bill that I often raise questions about, should everything that is proposed in that bill come to pass, it will place a great additional burden on the competition authorities. And I just wondered whether, as things stand, the allocation provided to the regulators is sufficient for them to carry out all the duties that would be expected of them should all those amendments be adopted by Parliament.
Thank you. Dr. Kado, any other questions?
Thank you very much, Chair. Mine is a small question for clarity. If the Minister could just remind us to who the trustees are for this new fund, the Tirisana Fund, just the trustees. I'm aware that there is this collaboration between the EDG and the IGC, but that there are trustees there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Kliani. Mr. Atkinson?
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Am I to understand correctly that the Tirisana Fund has not yet actually allocated any money? So everything we read at the moment is about what is about to happen. So at the moment, I sort of confirm that it's actually not an operational, whether it is an operational or not. Thank you.
Not an operational fund. That's what you're asking. Thanks, Mr. Atkinson. Ma'am Fulo?
Chair, I'm not a fan of the Tirisana Fund. I just want to understand because point number one is talking about contractors, development and provision of construction funds owned by Flexi. So for me, I just wanted to point number one is talking about Tirisana Trust Fund is talking about black contractors. So my question is around the relationship with, because there's also the construction sector. Also they are saying they are giving this training and everything. So I want to understand the relationship between these two. What is exactly when they say promotion of constructors? Are they going to give constructors money to start their business? Or is it part of training? Exactly what it is, because you'll find that the department of small businesses is also dealing with construction. You'll find that it is also construction city is dealing with it. So how do they relate? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ma'am Fulu. Any other? Those are the questions, Minister. I just wanted to find out, in terms of the... No, let me first thank the department really for putting all the funds the department is responsible for in one. This really helps us understand what we are dealing with here. Otherwise, we are going to say 1.1 billion. So the department has money, and you know, from the face value, it's a lot of money. But when you look at it, oh, sorry, very minute part of it is going towards the department, 13%. So when I look at, for instance, the is that the PICC? Let me start with the budget for the transfers towards the entities in general. Yes, I take it that what the department does is only monitoring of this entity. And to me, that's quite a huge responsibility under Program 3. Because when I look at your compensation of employees under this program, it's only 1.7%. Looking at the, I just wanted to find out, in terms of numbers, towards this particular program, are you satisfied that these numbers are okay and they are able to do that which you're supposed to be doing in as far as monitoring of this entity is concerned? Of course, when you look at the monies that have been transferred, you would think, no, that's nothing. But when I look at the functions, for instance, of CIFA in particular as a subsidiary of IDC, I know it's something that is wholly accounted for in the Small Business and Development Portfolio Committee, but because this particular entity is financed through our bigger entity, which is IDC, it therefore, to me, warrants the accountability also from this particular angle. Where I'm coming from, I'm looking at the issue around financing. You know, there's a slide there that explains the percentages, especially around CIFA's financing. I think it's talking about the lending, that is the wholesale vis-a-vis the direct lending. You know, having dealt with this matter in the fourth parliament, I still see our, you know, the direction being the same. When you look at the direct lending impact on SMME vis-a-vis wholesale in general. And I suspect, while I see the impact might be a little bit higher, but one wonders whether this is really benefiting the previously disadvantaged, or is it really benefiting the new and emerging enterprise, small enterprises. For instance, the wholesale, you'll talk of intermediaries that would be benefiting mostly. And when you look at the work of the intermediaries, more monies go towards them through, it means they're benefiting from here, and they're also benefiting through the year. So it's more about the interest end plus also what we transfer into them, what we are giving to them to manage this front end. So to me, it's a double-edged kind of a thing of benefit. So I had thought by now we should have reduced our over-reliance on intermediaries and more do more of a direct lending. I'm not sure whether that is clear. If I'm seeing things differently, please correct me, but this is my analysis. And if it's wrong, then it's better. But if I'm correct in that, because that disbursement is a lot towards the lending towards the wholesale lending towards the intermediary. Yes. I'm also looking at this particular area because I thought by now we should be talking more than what I'm seeing here in terms of contribution towards SMME, especially with the experience of ITC. I mean, ITC is more experienced even in small and medium enterprise lending. Maybe I should ask the overall question, whether do you see any impact in terms of the development of small, medium enterprises? Yes, we did get a presentation around that, but as a department, as the overseer of this particular fund, or do you see any positive impact in as far as small, medium enterprises are concerned through this particular fund or not? If you are pleased or not, especially from the political authority. Because I know you and me are talking the same language. Minister, in terms of ITEC, I just want my colleague has asked the question in relation to the competition authorities budget vis-a-vis the new amendments that will be coming. Mine is around ITEC. I'm just putting it officially here that we're having a challenge of time, whether we'll see the two legislation going through this financial year, and of course the budget should reflect as such that there will be changes towards the end of the financial year in terms of the implementation of the new legislation. If so, are we comfortable that if they are going through, then are we comfortable with the transfers that we're making, that they would actually be accommodated in the new legislation? I know the answer partly, but I just wanted to make it official so that it's registered. The inquiry and the levies towards the media, the outcome of that. The fund is not managed by us. Why is it managed by a separate body? What is it called? MCDA? Was the process not done through the same channels of our competition authority?
Which one is that?
The minister will respond to that. Okay. Thank you. I know it's a political decision, so it will be interesting also to understand it so that we are clear on that. Thank you. Thank you very much. Otherwise, I think the picture is very clear. looking at the whole thing. I know the competition authorities have put a bit of a complaint, but the resources, we understand that you are definitely responding to the request by cabinet that we put through the budget in February, and therefore we cannot force money to come out where it's not, where there's none. So yes, we have to operate within the limits that we've been given. May I then hand over to the minister for response? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the questions. I think the question that Honorable Cardo asked, I've got a direct response and then an overall response. The direct response is that I don't think the budgetary allocation we're making at the moment will enable the competition authorities to fully cover the new mandate that we have in mind. So as we expand the mandate of the authorities, money will have to flow with mandate, because an unfunded mandate will mean a poorly performed mandate. And the reason for that is competition is, I mean, it's a fascinating thing to see what competition investigations and hearings involve. I'm sorry, Chair, I'm abusing the fact that we've got a bit more time than normal to maybe just give some illustration, and honourable members can indicate if these are areas that has been covered before. Let's say one is a large merger. What the competition authorities have to deal with is they ask routine questions, there's forms that have to be filled in, then they've got to do an economic analysis. Let's say two companies merge. You've got to now look at the impact on the market as a whole. So you've got to do an economic assessment of the impact of a merger more broadly. So that's the day-to-day work of the Commission. As we ask the Commission to strengthen their work against cartels, they needed to do a lot more than that. They had to do investigations into markets where parties are not cooperating with it. Because in a merger, everybody's cooperating to an extent, provide the information, you assess it. So that led to a significant increase of the Commission's own income to cartel investigations. Now that we've looked at market inquiries, we've had a few market inquiries. What a market inquiry basically does, it provides an opportunity for the Commission to see what is the state of competition in a market. And it's a lot more, there's a lot of complexity. There are economic issues and there are legal issues that the Commission needs to take into account. If we deal with the LPG industry, there's a range of regulatory arrangements in place, so there are all the legal issues. And then there's the cost of LPG, the way in which the cost is accumulated through the value chain. And so you need expertise in each of those areas. If you don't, you've got a strong power, but no ability to make sure that the exercise of that power is founded on the evidence and a proper understanding of the law. It means then that you simply will have your decisions overturned in the courts. So if you want to have that mandate and you want to carry it out responsibly and properly, you've got to resource the institution. So the vision that I've put to the Commission is that in the years ahead, they have to become even more a center of best practice in South Africa. If you look at some of the competition and market authorities globally, take in the UK and elsewhere, they're able to attract the brightest and most energetic economists and lawyers in the society that work in the authority for a period. And we've got some strong people in the Commission, which is why we're winning so many cases. But there's scope for even more, to bring in even greater expertise. So I will be coming, well, I will be going to National Treasury and within the budget process, arguing for more resources. One of the things that we point out to Treasury constantly is that the competition authorities are a big money spinner for the state. It's not the intention, but all the fines that are levied are significantly higher than the budget of the authorities. So we say it makes sense to ensure that they are well equipped, because you actually recover that cost. So it's an investment rather than a sunken debt cost. So I'm hopeful that we can get more resources for the competition authorities in the years ahead. Principally the commission, less so the tribunal. The tribunal is an adjudicative body. If the quality of the work of the commission is good, there's lesser resources that the tribunal needs to make available, and it's principally part-time tribunal members, and they apply the law to the facts, and they make a ruling, and if the ruling is wrong, it goes to the Competition Appeal Court. So that's my direct short answer. The broader answer on the competition issue is one needs to think about what's the right funding mechanism for them. Do we, for example, take a portion of the fines and levies and reinvest it in the commission? We're testing that idea within the state. There's advantages and disadvantages to it. The advantage is that as you're more successful with your prosecution and you impose higher fines, a portion of that comes back to fund the activities. The disadvantage is generally in the state we don't like dedicated funds, because it means you can accumulate a massive surplus in a dedicated fund when you're having to go to money markets to borrow money for other state functions. And it means that people often find reasons to spend money. Lots of trips abroad, lots of unnecessary expenditure because you've got the budget. Whereas the culture must be cost containment even in times when there's no fiscal crisis, because we're dealing with essentially poor people's money and need to look after it properly. So there are also other disadvantages. So we're weighing those up and looking at it. So I do think whichever way we deal with it, that we need to see a significant increase in the resources. We will also need to probably review things like the balance between very skilled, better paid individuals and more junior staff. You can have a large number of junior staff, but you're not going to win your cases on the basis of the junior staff. It's going to be the top expertise that makes the real difference in whether you can crack a cartel, whether you can genuinely get deep insights in a market inquiry. And therefore, I would urge the commission, and I have urged the commission, relook the staffing model. Fewer, in a sense, don't go for a massive expansion in numbers, but go for top-class economists and top-class lawyers rather than the model of large number of middle-layer people who mean well but who are outgunned, if I may put it that way, with the economists and lawyers that the corporate sector can buy. A few questions came up on Tirisano funds, if I could take them as a collective chairperson. So starting with the question of the state of operation of the fund, essentially the fund has been established last year. We did all the technical work around the fund. We got the fund trust deed through the deeds office. We appointed National Treasury in terms of our agreement, appoints the fund administrator. So though it's the IDC, it's not appointed by me, it was appointed by National Treasury. And we got the first contributions flowing in on the income side. We've appointed some trustees from the government side, Teboho Malachi and Trevor Fowler as the two. And now with the cabinet reshuffle done, some of the ministers now will be nominating persons to the fund. The construction companies also nominated people from their side. I don't have the names of their trustees immediately available, but it would be available at the next sitting of the committee where I'm present. I could happily share that. So it's operational on the income side. It now is looking at exactly the expenditure side. What kind of projects should it support? And we can expect that those would begin to come through the pipeline in this financial year. In respect of Honorable Mfulu's question, when we got these companies to acknowledge the involvement in the cartel, we said to them, by way of turning a page and starting afresh in the society, support the entry of black construction companies into the industry. Now what the CETA does is, the CETA does training of the staff of a company, and generally, frankly, middle layer. But what a construction company like WBHO can do is, they now are tasked to have three partners, black-owned companies, one led by a black woman, and they give a high-level support, the kind of support you need when you put together a major tender document, where you've got to do the costing. Now, if you get your costing wrong in a tender, you can basically go bankrupt, because you agree to undertake a set of tasks at a specified price, and if your pencil was over sharp, you're basically legally obliged to carry it out, even if you're losing money. If your pencil is too blunt, then your cost is going to be too high and someone else is going to grab the tender. I'm talking about an honest legal tender now. So that will help with something like that. Let's say if you build a bridge in a big urban area, you need very high level, good technical engineering skills, skills that enable you to look at the geological issues. You know, is there a high chance of sinkholes in that area? If there is, you know, you can imagine what it would mean to a bridge. The strength of the steel that you need to use, the concrete, all of those things you need. So it's technical support there, which is not something that the construction CETA would offer. So it's another element that often is missing, because the CETAs can do one thing, but it's these high-level skills that uniquely belong to the big companies. There's not even anyone in government with some of that expertise, because anyone with that expertise would be paid a lot more than the president of the country is paid, and then they make those skills available in the private sector, and they make money on it. That's how the model works, and it's how the model works throughout the world. So what we've encouraged the Tirisano Fund to do is, we've said, take account of not so much the construction CETA, but the CIDB, the Construction Industry Development Board's work on rating companies and giving them the CIDB grading. And that grading system allows you, if you tender for public projects, you say if you're going to do a big, let's say Parliament is going to build housing for parliamentarians in a new area. Now, that's a big project. A lot of companies tender. You've got to disclose your CIDB certification. When you disclose that, Parliament will say, what's the minimum level you need to have reached before Parliament can accept you as a construction company? Because Parliament can't just take myself, if I leave this job and I start a construction company and the next day I put in a tender, I've got no record, I've got no ability to convince Parliament that I can run a project as big as a massive housing development. So that's, I think, the kind of coordination that we say we want to foster. Chairperson, thank you for the comments that you've made. And you've asked a few pointed questions. The one question you've asked is very directly whether we have the right number of staff to carry out the oversight in Program 3 over the entities. And my answer is, I think we should strengthen the caliber of the staff, not the numbers. I don't currently have anybody on the books that would be able to do the technical work on the IDC accounts. The IDC, remember, is a massive, it's one of the largest corporate entities in the country. It runs an asset base of more than 100 billion rand. It's got an annual investment approval of about 14, 15 billion rand. It's enormous. It employs a CFO that is, of experience and caliber that is quite senior in the industry. So if we want to strengthen our oversight, not so much over the finances, but over the programs of the entities, then we need the caliber staff that fits with that. And that's where I think, if I can be reflective and acknowledge where I think we've got our challenges, it's at that level. When you bring someone that's got a relatively modest skill set to sit with a senior executive of the IDC, there isn't going to be oversight. Oversight requires the technical ability, because remember, this is technical oversight. It's the ability to follow the money and see that it is being utilized properly. So we've got a couple of people that I think at the programmatic level are good in the department, but not a sufficient number of that high level skills. So we rely on the small universe of people to do that. And they get overstretched. They get stretched very tightly. And that's risky in the long run. They leave, they retire or something like that, then you've got a gap. So I do identify that as a medium-term risk, not even a long-term risk, a medium-term risk that we need to mitigate by bringing more people in who can do that kind of work. On the interesting set of reflections on CIFA, it's a complex thing, Chairperson, because having given policy oversight to another portfolio, another colleague, we need to manage it in such a way that we're always supportive of that portfolio. Because if one doesn't do that, an institution gets tugged between two principles, if you like, and that's the end of the institution. It goes to pieces then, because then it becomes factionalized, and you'll have one grouping supporting one principle and another grouping supporting another principle, and that's the end of good governance. So it's got to be, we've got to intervene with wisdom not to open that gap. And so far the department, I think, has not really found the proper way to get into that space. And I've begun to raise it. I raised it late last year with one of the senior staff of the department that we need to now get a much more collaborative model between the EDD staff and the Small Business Development Department staff. We have the technical expertise that they could benefit from. I mean, for example, one of the staff members who's been in the committee previously, Mohamed Wouter, has the technical ability from his own experience and skills base to do an analysis of the financials of CIFA. And I think the Small Business Development Department could use that very well, and we haven't done that to date. So you're signaling to us an area that we have to go in. If I think of CIFA, CIFA's got, call it, four broad cost centers. The first one is administration, so the staff that are paid generally to do your broad CIFA promotion and so on. That would be one. A second one is CIFA Direct, and I'll come back to that in more detail, but it's basically the staff who directly lends money to small businesses. The third one are your intermediaries. That's where CIFA transfers money to someone else who manages on behalf of CIFA. And the fourth one is a portfolio of properties that CIFA has that it needs to maintain and spend money on a regular basis. So those are the four cost centers that I would identify. So take the one, administration is a given, and one can do more there, but I think that that's a given. The second one, which is CIFA Direct, the chairperson has got a long memory, I can see, and she's absolutely right. In 2012, 2013, most of the money in CIFA, by far the bulk of it, like something like probably 90% or more, was given to intermediaries. And there were two problems with the intermediaries. The one problem was the interest rates were often very high. 28%, 29%. They had lots of hidden fees that meant that your actual rate was even higher. You know, these some of the micro-lenders do it. And the second thing is that the state had no ability to properly assess the impact of its lending. So we introduced a CIFA direct model based on it that we had started it with CULA. It was called CULA direct and it became CIFA direct. And over the years, more money began to flow inside CIFA towards the CIFA direct model, which in some ways is a good thing in terms of policy. The problem is CIFA began to carry the risk of making the right decisions on loans. And over the last few years, it's my impression that that's not an area where CIFA has invested enough to build the capability. So when I look at impairment ratio is the money when you lend it out that you know you're not going to get back. The impairment ratio is too high. Look, we do accept CIFA must have an impairment ratio. You want your small business agencies to be aggressive lenders. In other words, they mustn't be like a commercial bank that wants too much security, protection for their money. Somebody in the society must step forward to help new players and small business. But you can't also throw money away. And so getting that balance right is important. And as I've indicated, it's an area that we've got to manage with some degree of sensitivity because policy responsibility has shifted. So what I've done is I've sat with the IDC, because as I remember, it's still ultimately the wholly owned subsidiary. And I've said to them, I want a more explicit paragraph in their corporate plan this year that deals with CIFA. And if you look at the corporate plan, you'll see it there. It's not in the formal indicators. It's there, there's an indicator, it's also in the text of the document. So I'm saying to the IDC, your job is to strengthen CIFA's risk assessment abilities. They don't have the right tools to be able, when someone walks into their office and say, look, I need a loan, they're not able to properly assess the risk, and then to work with a person to bring the risk down. Because you don't want to just turn away someone just because there is a higher risk than you normally take. You first want to see, can you bring the risk down? How can you bring the risk down? For example, if they're paying too much on rent, you may say, look, why don't you move to another premises? Or if they managing their stocks very badly, you buy an enormous amount of stuff, you make it, and it sits in your warehouse. It's eating your capital. Every minute it sits there unsold, it's actually eating your capital. So you then say, okay, look, let's have a proper stock turnover policy where you only produce enough that you need to sell in the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever the story is. I'm just giving these as examples. Now, I don't think that we're doing enough from the IDC side on that. And again, everybody's oversensitive because they don't want to be seen to step on the toes of another portfolio, but by no one wanting to step forward because you don't step on toes, we're not getting the maximum value out of CIFA. And I think when I speak to my colleague, the Minister of Small Business Development, she believes in cooperation and working together. So I think we have a partner there where we can do more. Then we need to push it a little bit from our side and get more done. So on the specific issues that's come out of that, I think overall there is a reduction in the percentage of money that's gone to intermediaries. But more recently, I've been told that CIFA, because of the high impairment on the CIFA Direct, they're again looking at whether they shouldn't use the intermediary model. I happen to think, and I know it's a bit of an unconventional thought in this case, but I happen to think that CIFA must also form a better partnership with the big banks. because the banks have a lot of branches all over, and CIFA's got funding from the state, and we can utilize those branch officials to assess, in addition to the things we're doing, not in place of what we're doing, that we can reach more people, but also improve the risk profile. So it means forming partnerships. You've seen, for example, where Home Affairs has formed partnership with the banks, that you can get more done quickly. So I think that that model is one that we can do more on. And then, Chair, you asked really the hard and important question, what's the impact of our work on small business development? I think what the state does have a positive effect, but I don't think it has as big an impact as it can. And that is a function of two things, at least two things, probably more than just two. One is tight integration. We're beginning to do some of it through CIFA. CIFA, for example, now provides more and more of its loans through or two companies that also have a tender from the state. So what you now have is if someone has got a tender from the state, means that they've got an order, and they've got an order book that needs to be financed. So you're not putting money in the hope that the person can find customers. You're putting money in and they've got a secured customer. Now that's fine in the short term. The trick is if you stay there, it means the business is always dependent on the state. It becomes like a welfare model. They need funding from the state, they need an order from the state. The minute either of the two dries up, they come running to us and say, please, you know, you've killed our business. But it means we can't release our tenders for the next person. We can't release our funding for the next person. We only have to feed the existing people that are in the system. So it's not a good long-term model. So what you've got to do is you've got to turn it around. You've got to say to someone, we're giving you funding for 3 years. And we're going to be tough. We want to see that you make profit. We don't want your profit. You must pay us our loan back. But we want you to run a profitable business so that when we step out, you can go into a normal bank and they can fund you so that we take that money and we then bring the next South African in and the next one. And I think that's where I think we're not doing enough, Chairperson. And if you're asking me where our impact can be, I think that's an area where we're not making the right impact. Coming next to the ITAC issue, I do think, Chairperson, that as we adjust the mandate of ITAC, there will be budget pressures. But I'm not convinced that ITAC can't reprioritize. I think there is scope. It's tricky. It means working with the staff, and there may be some concerns that the unions raise. So that would have to be worked through. They would have to invest a lot in trying to win a degree of support. They'll have to make some tough decisions in how to allocate staff. But where I think there may be a valid grounds for more resources is on anti-dumping investigations. We do virtually no anti-dumping investigations. Now, it must come from the private sector, but I think we're not active enough when we see evidence of dumping to help the private sector to put together their case. Now, legally, our hands are clean. We can say, well, it's their responsibility in terms of the law. But you can't run a society like that, that you want to keep your hands constantly clean and say, it's not my responsibility. If I see someone is driving towards a little kid in the road and they're going to knock the kid, I can't say I'm not the driver and it's not my kid, it's someone else's kid. You take action because that's the responsibility we have as members of a society. You run in, you try to save the kid, you shout at the driver, whatever you do. Now similarly, we need to get that capacity in ITAC strengthened, where it can support the investigations by collecting information rather than leaving it simply to the applicants to do. They put too much responsibility on the private sector, and often it's hard for the private sector to meet all of that. And then we end up blaming the private sector, saying, well, the companies are not giving the information. So I think that that's an area where there is a valid grounds for more resources. On the the media case, Chairperson. Now, the Competition Commission has to do two things. It has to impose a penalty, and once it's imposed a penalty in terms of the Act, it can't control what happens to that money. It goes to the National Revenue Fund. EDD can try to talk to Treasury, but we can't say where that money must go. So we had to talk to Treasury and get agreement on the Steel Development Fund. Even though we're collecting $1.5 billion, it then goes into the general pot of the National Revenue Fund. And if Parliament decides all of that money goes to housing, that's Parliament's decision. So what the Commission has done over the years, and it started with a pioneer case that I know you can recall when there was a bread cartel and poultry cartel. And we got involved, and the competition authorities had just been transferred to economic development. And I sat down with a company who said they wanted to settle, and I said, look, one of the components of the settlement will have to be that you're going to have to bring down prices, and a second component will have to be that you have to contribute towards a fund that will support competitors and small businesses to get into agro-processing. Eventually the company agreed, we reached an agreement with the commission, and it went to the tribunal. Treasury then went to the tribunal and said, but hang on, this is a special fund that's outside the National Revenue Fund. And you remember there was a big news story, Minister Patel and so on. In the end, we said, okay, we'll change the terms. Let the money go to the National Revenue Fund. But let it come from the National Revenue Fund back to EDD. The whole sum was R250 million. And we'll put it into the IDC for this Agro-Processing Competitiveness Fund. And it worked well, and I think that fund has had a very positive effect. And we should actually take the committee at some stage through that fund and its operation. So what's done now with this media case is the Competition Commission was concerned that if it simply imposes a fine, the companies may object and take it to the tribunal, Competition Appeal Court. And secondly, even if the commission wins it, there may be the challenge of it going into the general pot. So they said, because these big media companies, Media 24 and so on, they're large ones. They squeeze the little players out of the market. The case, if you recall, was around community newspapers that were being squeezed out by what is called predation or predatory pricing, which is where you bring your price down very low. You undercut the other guy. He goes out of business, and then you raise your price. Now, that's not permitted in our law. You can't do that. You can bring your price down to win market share, but you can't have a deliberate strategy to knock your competitor out of the market and then raise your price. So they then agreed on a fine and everything, and they put it in the MDDA, and the MDDA is the Media Development and Diversity Agency, which is a statutory body. So it is a body that has a statutory responsibility around media diversity, and I think that's why they chose that agency and is utilizing the agency to do the particular work on media diversity, because obviously inside government you don't have that. EDD wouldn't be able to do something like that. We better at your kind of hard industrial investment in infrastructure, but promoting media diversity is the specific mandate of the MDDA, and that's why they've put it in. On the Terisano Fund, it was an agreement between us and the construction companies. It's really, in some ways, they regard it as their money. But we're bringing it through a public accountability process to make sure that there's oversight. They're saying to us, well, you know, it's clumsy, it's indirect doing it this way. They're not happy, but we insisted to date that the money must come through this very transparent process, so that you can ask the questions that the honourable members have asked today. If it hadn't gone through the National Revenue Fund, the ability of accountability is lost. And, you know, if you have angels, it doesn't matter, but you can't design a fund that's got a 12 to 14 year duration on the assumption that there will never be problems. You must assume that there will be periods when there may be problems, so give the representatives of the people the right to information. And that protects us long term, because these funds will outlast all of us. So, Chair, that's on the question of the media funding. I'm not sure if there's anything that we've skipped in the reply that perhaps the CFO or the DG wants to add. But I also want to invite through you the Deputy Minister, if there's anything the DM would like to add to the replies. Thank you.
Oh, you covered. Gigi?
You know, on the CIFA, Chairperson, the CIFA is actually running four revenue cost centers. Now, two of them do experience problems. As Minister was saying, the direct lending and also the portfolio. Right? But the positive side that is there that mitigates against those problems is, yes, indeed, is the transfer that we make. Right? And also that wholesale lending. Because those two centers or pots of money, they actually address the problems that in the main are coming from the property portfolio, because that property portfolio is actually projected to, it has been making losses this year. For instance, they say it will be about 50% loss that probably they might have, but it's scaling down 33% next year, and that other year 17. At least there is some improvement in there. Right. But the side that they still need to be able to wrap their heads around is the direct lending. Right. Because in that direct lending, those are the small amounts, right, but from many businesses, but they are not recovered. Now, there they need to actually to make that balancing act, right? And in fact, Chairperson, we indeed ourselves, we do have this challenge of capacity of analysts to be able to track, to make sure that improvement, that efficiency within the CIFA is actually realized. But we are actually working with the IGC through their shareholder compact to be able to see what is it that needs to be done there. So it's that balancing act between these two sources.
Thanks for that. But I just want to find out, does the PEP policy cover also the CIFA of the IDC in terms of
the PEP?
PEP, the Minister would understand better.
Yes. Well, that would have to be a directive, obviously, that is given by the Minister of Small Business Development. So I'll check. maybe the IDC could impose it. I would favour that it is. You know, that one should just have transparency in all these things. Well, that's the protection that the public has. So let me check that, Chair, whether the Board has asked that it applies to the CIFA portfolio also.
Because one is worried about the impairment, it's just too much. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Irene.
Yes.
I know the first name. The second, is it Ramaphosa?
Ramaphosa.
Oh, Ramaphosa. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
The reporter.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, I just want to talk about the finances with regards to the Tirisano Fund. So the allocation for the 2017-18, which was 117, that has been transferred to the Tirisano Fund. There were specific conditions that National Treasury did outline, and then one of them was the MOA, which needed to be signed between ourselves and the trust administrators, being the IDC, that has been done. And then now the only part that's left, which is slightly delaying the implementation, as the Minister has alluded, is the trustees endorsing the draft plan before they can disperse the funds to the actual project.
Can you repeat the expenditure to date?
Okay. So to date, it is 117 million. So that has been transferred to the Tirisano Fund in line with. So in terms of, let me just take you back slightly. In terms of the conditions that are coming from National Treasury, okay, as EDD, we needed to sign an MOA between ourselves and IDC, being the trust administrator. That has been done, and then we've transferred the funds, and then they needed to see a draft annual plan as to how they're going to be disbursing the funds to the project. Now, with regards to them finalizing the plan, that's where the delay is coming in for them to implement. Because now the trustees, I think this is the part that the minister has spoken about, Minister. Because the trustees now don't want the funds to go through the national revenue. But we have transferred, and then Minister and actually our PICC, Minister, IDC, they are on top of that. They should be finalizing that annual plan, and then we should start implementing based on the funds we've transferred.
Basically, out of 1.5 billion, there's only 117 spent.
Correct.
Not spent.
It has now
transferred. Yes. It's transferred to the trust.
Yes.
For what?
Okay. So the transfer is to Chairperson. The transfer is so that they can start implementing the plan that they have put in place. But now, before they can start transferring. Or rather utilizing the funds, they need to complete, the trustees need to endorse that plan before they can transfer to the different projects.
And on that, do trustees get anything out of that?
Chairperson, no. the 117 is not for the trustees. The trustees?
Yeah, I'm just asking so that it's very clear that the money 117 million.
Okay.
And because most of the time you appoint administrators, you appoint what, and then at the end of the day that money ends up being gobbled by the personnel operational funds more than the actual business way it's intended to.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to answer that, you are correct, but in this case, because we have the trust administrator being the IDC, which is where the funds are going, so the funds are not going directly to the trust. They're going to the IDC, and then IDC will then disperse the funds to the trustees, or to the trust rather, for the project based on the plan, as and when that takes place.
And then report back.
So okay. the IDC will then report back to ourselves, and then we need to report to National Treasury. Yes.
And how often would that be?
Okay, we're doing that on a quarterly basis, Chairperson.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after every financial year ends, they need to submit audited financial statements for the trust as well. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for that info. Obviously, we will be looking into that because we would want the money to go straight to where it was intended to go to. Thank you so much. Any further questions? So, late. After that, we're fine. Okay, let me take this opportunity to thank the leadership of this department, led by the Minister and the Deputy Minister. We really once more want to thank you for the proper way, the thorough way of doing things. Information is straightforward, it's easy to read, it's user-friendly. Thank you so much for that. We really appreciate it. And members, thank you so much also for attending and also for participating in the meeting. The meeting stands adjourned. I thought we'd finish early.